Welcome to the podcast version of MGO Radio, 5 to 7 on WTKA 1050 AM. If you call in now, nobody will answer you, so don't do that unless you like wasting your time. To MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Mohs. We hope that you are living a better life with the guidance of Mahatma Gandhi, as we, of course, are every week.
I'm feeling quite uplifted heading into
yes.
the show now.
Say something spiritual, Ace. Is that better than how you're so bad at this?
I mean,
I'm going to replace you with the Alumni Association's Kevin Woodard.
You probably should. It's overdue.
All right. So you have to leave for the last hour of the show because you have to cover the game at Elon.
Yes.
Against Elon. Yeah. Not at Elon. The fight in Christians.
Why did they change that, man? That mascot was just beautifully nightmare fuelish.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, go to the blog, mgoblog.com. It's the top post, and it's just the mascot of, well, until about the 70s, the mascot of the school that we were going up against.
Until 1999, incredibly, they were still the fight in Christians.
You'd think that, well.
Once you get there, you might as well just hold on.
But, yeah.
You
know.
Now they're the Phoenix, which is so much more boring.
That is so boring. Oh, well. We have to make some sacrifices in order for everyone to be happy all the time.
Yep.
No politics.
Nope.
No politics. Michigan beats Indiana 48-41 in double overtime in a game that was not at all scary.
No, definitely not.
Not at all terrifying.
That's why we're talking in totally calm tones at this point.
Let's just talk about the offense first because that's fun.
That's better, yes.
So Jake Rudock, 440 yards, 6 touchdowns, 1 interception that I kind of mostly blame on the coaching staff, but we'll get back to that. Second straight week, he has just been completely on. And this week, you know, last week against Rutgers, he was very, very good, but he didn't actually hit anything more about 20, 25 yards. In this game, he extended that range well downfield with a series of shots that – I was just like, finally.
Yeah. No, that was definitely the pervasive feeling, especially in the first half. As Michigan jumped out to that lead, it was just, I mean, obviously the first touchdown, you know, to start it off with a true shot over the top on a touchdown to Chesson was great. And Rudock was just, I mean, in addition to being on point as a passer, he was Michigan's best running threat on the day. And,
yeah.
And in a very critical way.
Let's not talk about that part yet because that's not fun.
Yeah, it's less fun. Although the Rudock doing his, you know, Denard Devin impression is fun. It's the rest of the running game that was less fun.
Yeah. But we saw that, you know, that hit over the top was, for one, a smart play because they jumped off sides.
Yes.
And for two, that like 30 to 35 yard route down the sideline is something I'd seen him hit repeatedly as an Iowa quarterback. And it drove me crazy during the season when he couldn't do that because I had told everybody again that like Rudock can do this.
It drove us crazy too, Brian.
Well, like after the last couple of years of quarterback prognostication from myself, I was taking it personally in a way that didn't make any sense.
They're out to get you, man.
You don't know that it's not true. You don't know that.
What do you think about Brandon Peters these days?
Brandon Peters is the worst. I can't even say that with a straight face.
I know. His senior film dropped, and it's ridiculous.
Do you want to talk about that for a little bit?
I'm okay with it.
Oh, I love it. All right. So Huddle.com, Brandon Phillips. What am I even talking about?
That's a baseball player, and man.
I think
where did that come from?
I think I confused him with Brian Phillips. Anyway. Just Google his actual name, which I've completely forgotten now.
Brandon Peters.
Brandon Peters. Thank you. and he's got a 10-minute highlight tape, which is it's really advanced, which I love.
Yeah.
So there will be like a 2 to 3 minute section of it where you're just wondering if this guy actually has much arm strength. And then he'll just zip one in like we've seen Shane Morris do. And it kind of dawns on you. That's the reason
he's got touch.
The reason that all these other throws look a little bit, you know, delicate and slow is because he's just taking some mustard off the ball so they're easier to catch, which is kind of like, oh.
That is incredibly advanced for a high school quarterback, especially a guy with that kind of ability where you could really excuse somebody for just letting it rip every time.
Yeah, but He throws a really catchable ball, and when he puts it over the top, the arc on that thing is gorgeous.
Yeah, and I loved watching that film because it kind of reaffirmed. I got to see him once in person this year and once in a game that was televised nationally, and he looked like that in those two games. And then to see it spread across the entire season, I mean, far and away the best high school QB I've seen in person. He is so far ahead of where Shane Morris was at this stage. And Morris obviously had his lost senior season in high school a little bit. But also, I was pretty impressed with where Alex Malzone was last year, both in terms of just his game management and his accuracy. But Peters is just on a completely different level physically from him. And he's a more refined passer.
Yeah, so pretty exciting for, I guess, not next year, because nobody wants to see a true freshman quarterback no matter how good they are. But
you never know. It's going to be tough. It'd be scary if it happened, but I wouldn't necessarily rule out at least him. I mean, he's going to enroll early. He's going to be there in the spring. I wouldn't put it out of the question that he'll at least be in the competition.
They've been really talking up O'Korn. So
they also really talked up Lawrence Marshall, in the spring or whatever. So.
A little bit different because the team is actually participating in the O'Korn hype.
But
which didn't really so much happen with Marshall. But anyway,
I've been burned too many times with the practice hype,
That's talking about next year. Let's get back to this year.
Yes.
So Rudock's most impressive throw in this game was a 64-yard touchdown to J.U. Chesson, which was really about a 25-yard dig route where he threw it. He decided to throw it, I think, before Chesson was even in his break.
Yeah. No, ESPN actually gave us a really great all-22 overhead angle of that one. And you could see he perfectly recognized that the cornerback was trailing and that he had a pretty tight window to fit that ball into where the safety wouldn't be able to get it. And it was actually even a tiny bit behind Chesson, but that kept it away from the safety.
Yeah, I'm not gonna really point that out. That seems seems like nitpicking the Mona Lisa right there.
No, absolutely. I'm saying that made it an even better throw was that it gave the safety even less of a chance to get over there, and then just was helped out a little bit by the safety in corner then immediately running into each other.
They were so baffled by that throw, they didn't know what to do.
I mean, and they're also, Indiana defensive backs.
Let's try to stay positive.
That's true. I mean, the throw was incredible. Yeah, and Chesson is very fast, so he got the edge and then scored, and that was great.
Yeah, and I think we saw, a glimpse of a different J.U. Chesson, a more dominant J.U. Chesson, the kind of guy who we had hoped we might see early in the year, and he kept getting overthrown. And then there were a couple of passes that he dropped, and there were a couple of passes that he didn't adjust to. But in this game, he made all the catches that he should.
Yeah.
And on the final drive of regulation, Rudock, first of all, he just punts it up because he sees that Chesson has an advantage. He's one-on-one against a cornerback who's no good, and he's about to get blown up. So the throw isn't great. But he gets it out there so his guy can make a play, and Chesson makes that play.
Yeah, and he really had to adjust to come back for that one, too. That was a lot more difficult than some of the throws that he's had a tough time with previously.
Yeah, and the Chesson's rep has always been a guy who, great athlete, great guy, but was very raw as a wide receiver, and I think that's pretty much borne itself out over the course of his career. And this is a game where it's like, is he putting it together? Because if the proverbial click happens with him, then you might have a star guy for next year.
Yeah, I mean, if he, adding a true downfield threat to his game, because he's been able to run by guys, but, proving that you can actually turn that into something is a completely different thing. You combine that with the fact that he's good on screens, he's good on those end arounds, and he's a heck of a blocker, too. He's really a complete player if he gets that down.
Yeah, he's a guy who, if we see him continue to do this in the next couple of weeks, it's like feeling pretty good.
And he's the fastest guy on this team.
Yeah, we've upgraded him from Stoneham-esque to Breston-esque.
Yes.
We might have to go to Manningham if this continues.
Yeah.
Which would be real nice. And meanwhile, we saw Amara Darbo with the kind of muscly underneath possession receiver stuff that is a great compliment to Chesson and also kind of like what his rep was. So twice in this game, he catches balls short of the sticks and kind of carries defensive backs past them. And that's the kind of thing that is really encouraging, especially when you pair it with that catch he had earlier in the year against Oregon State. Or is it UNLV? I forget.
BYU was the one-hander.
Oh, then BYU. So, just He had like one drop in this game on a 55-yarder, but he caught that ball and then it got knocked loose when he hit the ground.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit tough.
Yeah, not the easiest catch.
To put too much blame on him for that one. But neither of these guys, I think, is like the A-plus player yet. But you're seeing signs that they're developing, are getting comfortable in the system. And we had a lot of worries about wide receiver before the season that I don't think we really have anymore.
No, and especially since their skill sets really complement each other really well in terms of, I mean, Chesson's more of the burner and downfield guy and can do the, take handoffs, and Darbo is the reliable possession guy who can also go up and get balls in traffic and move the chains. I mean, he had, that was kind of a quiet 109 yards he had, all things considered.
Yeah.
And, it does help when Indiana forgets to guard you on a corner route.
That was Chesson.
Oh, that's right. That was Chesson.
But
it would help if I remembered who Indiana forgot to guard.
Yeah, Darbo was the guy who got forgotten by Rutgers last week, so that's understandable. Right. And then you add Jake Butt into that, who is impeccable when it comes to catching anything that is remotely catchable and has an athleticism that allows him to get by or over linebackers and safeties. And that's a pretty solid receiving core.
Absolutely. And now we've seen Rudock over the past few weeks really warm up to just putting the ball up to these guys. I'd say especially Jake Butt. He's really starting to just get the ball in that,
butt zone.
Yeah, the butt zone.
The butt zone where only Jake Butt can go get the ball. And he's really, really good at that.
He is.
Looks like an NFL tight end when that happens. But he's obviously too short until next year.
Absolutely. Everybody's coming back.
Everybody's coming back. But we should probably get to the unfun stuff.
Yeah. Pretty much.
So the least fun thing for me in this game was the interception, which came on 2nd and 20. Michigan has one wide receiver on the field. They run play action. They throw it at A.J. Williams. And I'm like, you know what? If this was 1st and 10, I bet that's open. But on 2nd and 20, when you're banking on deception to get your tight end open against a defensive back, that's not going to go so well. And that's a throw that Rudock should absolutely not make.
Yeah.
But I also think that the play call there put him behind the eight ball from the start of that play and was pretty gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, because that route to Williams is coming across the field, and that's a play where you're hoping that the linebacker jumps up on the play action fake.
Right.
And the linebacker, T-Gray Scales, instead was just dropping right into that route from the jump.
From the jump, yeah.
And that was not good.
Not good. And then the run game, statistically okay. You need 5 yards a carry, but the Rudock stuff plays into that.
He averaged 9.1.
Right. So, Smith had 4.8 yards a carry, but often those yards came when he broke a tackle and then got a bunch after contact, which is nice. But there were also times when he popped outside the tackle and I'm like, oh, this is going to be successful. And then an Indiana linebacker ran him down. I'm like, ugh. Because he's Devion Smith and he doesn't really work in space.
Yeah, I think they ran a toss to him at one point and it was just like it took so long to get to the point of attack that it absolutely had no chance of success. And I think if Drake Johnson was running that play, it might have got a few yards at least. And with Smith, it was a tackle at the line of scrimmage.
Well, then they run that toss play on the line of scrimmage on 3rd and goal where they substitute in Drake Johnson. They run the same play they ran with Drake Johnson on the goal line against Rutgers. Indiana jumps, it gets a guy in the backfield, and that's just kind of like
they had seen that film.
Way too obvious.
Yeah.
So, but to be in that position when you just ran Huma at the line twice in a row and got nowhere, this offensive line has some questions, I think, still to be answered about whether they can actually move anybody off the ball.
Absolutely, because this was an Indiana defensive line that really has, maybe two quality players on it out of the four, they were getting bashed out of the hole by Iowa repeatedly in the game that I was watching to prepare for this week. And I mean, they've been, and the stats back it up too. I mean, they've been run over pretty much all year, except I think by Michigan State, who's also had their share of struggles.
Yeah, Michigan State was the only other team that didn't really crush them statistically.
And I think that was a game where State was pretty banged up on the O-line.
Yeah. It's frustrating, too, especially because the offensive line took like 3 or 4 false start penalties.
There were a lot of procedure penalties.
And if you're going to take 4 false start penalties, I'd like them to be concentrated in one guy so I can be angry at that one guy instead of kind of like existentially depressed about all of it.
Yep.
Yeah, not so good.
I think the one guy who kind of stands out there is Graham Glasgow's had a lot of those this year. And for a center, that's a little, strange. More concerning.
Yeah. But. Like there's just points where they don't have the snap count, but it seems like a lot of people are doing it. When Cole's doing it, you're like, man, this just isn't going that great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the running backs are just, they're the running backs.
It says a lot that Huma is.
Number two or something.
Yeah, he was the second back in this game.
Yeah. Says a lot.
Michigan goes the Tongan Weissman route.
Yes. Frippery, not so much in this one.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you're going up against a team that's so easy to just beat straight up through the air.
Yeah.
It was pretty frustrating to see Michigan try all manner of misdirection and trick plays and just have them go backwards.
Yeah, so there was a touchdown drive that Michigan had. Their one like long drive of the first half.
109 positive yards on that one.
But also two catches on which Jake Butt got negative 18 yards between them, which is one.
What?
Wow. Two, he scored a touchdown on that drive. So that's another like wow.
Yeah. All kinds of wows on that drive.
But they put that stuff mostly away except for an end around to Peppers that Peppers made a lot worse than it had to be because he's not experienced at being a college back. And so he tried to cut it around upfield, and it's just like you're probably going to lose a couple yards on that one, but you could have lost two instead of 10.
Yeah.
So for people who are suggesting that Peppers should be the running back, that's kind of an indicator that it's going to be a little bit tougher than that to adapt to the increased speed of college defenses.
Yeah, and you think Michigan fans would know by now that running into the correct place is pretty critical for a running back.
Bad. Peppers did have a screen on, I think it was like 2nd and 13 or something, where he just exploded upfield.
Yeah, two guys had an angle on him on that one.
Yeah. And that didn't feel so much like frippery. It was just running a pretty basic play with your super freak.
Yeah, you're running a bubble screen to a crazy fast guy. Makes sense.
It does make sense. And then they had one where he got down to the 1 yard line on the goal line where they just ran a bubble with him. And that looked like they had it dead to rights. And then Peppers was just like, nope.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually so similar to the other screen that I thought you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. No. Previously.
Because two guys had that completely dead.
I was talking about a tunnel screen that happened earlier.
There was also that.
Yeah.
So, the regular stuff to Peppers, the stuff that would be in just about any team's playbook, is fine. But then when they had that weird look where they had him split out in a way that was kind of screaming bubble screen to one side and then tried to run a deep route off of that. It didn't work. And then they had the throwback screen to Jake Butt with him as a decoy. And the stuff where he's a decoy.
Indiana had that pretty well scouted.
Yeah, they knew what was coming, it seemed like.
Yeah, they got to move the screen target to someone else, maybe Huma instead of Butt, but not this week, next week.
Yeah.
All right, we got to get to a break. On the other side, we will talk about the not-so-good part of this game. Phone lines are open, 734-998-1050. This is WTK. This is also MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Mohs. In 1934, a salesman from Champion Sportswear walked into Mohs Sports Shop. There, he teamed up with George J. Moe to create the very first University of Michigan-branded shirt. After seeing the high demand for this product, Champion went to the other Big Ten schools with the same proposal, and the collegiate apparel industry was born. Mohs Sports Shop is celebrating 100 years of outfitting the Michigan faithful. Visit us at our original 1915 location at 711 North University or online at 100years.mo. That's 100years.moe.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Eufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
Sports Talk 1050 WTKA.
Welcome back to MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Mohs. Yes, this is ukulele week on the MGO audio areas.
It is.
Because the Tongan Terrors, this is the name we have given the band that is consists of Brian Monet and Sione Huma.
The name we are giving them, whether they like it or not.
if they tell us they don't like it, I guess we'll change it.
I probably wouldn't argue with them.
They're very large.
They are.
doesn't do well to argue with football players.
No.
But anyway, so Sione Huma says that he likes to play the ukulele and Brian Monet sings.
Apparently they will not be doing a public performance, which is somewhat devastating.
It is devastating. But anyway, so we spent most of the week in our Slack chat just Googling various hilarious ukulele covers of
songs.
No,
we were doing important work, Brian. Come on. we don't waste a ton of time on there.
Well, I mean, mostly we just talk about how Brandon Peters' film is completely awesome. But yeah.
Yeah. There's that too.
Yeah.
And Giphy.
Giphy. Defense, not so much. So can we be done with that now? Or is it?
Yeah, let's talk about Giphy.
No. Giphy is worse than the defense. So Glasgow is out of this game. And I think due to a combination of factors, including the frank brilliance of Kevin Wilson deciding to attack that, Michigan's run defense really kind of fell to pieces.
It did.
And so Kevin Wilson starts out running the ball, gets in a fourth and short on their first drive, and Michigan punches him off the field.
And for a lot of coaches, that'd be the end of that.
Yeah. And then Michigan scores in four plays, which, yay, we scored in four plays. Indiana gets the ball back. They have an 11-play drive. They convert a fourth down, and Michigan's getting a little tired. Michigan goes three and out. Indiana gets the ball back. They go on a 17-play drive featuring another conversion. That was third and 10. Indiana throws a screen to get it to like third and three.
Yeah, they're looking at it's two downs the whole way.
Yeah, and they go for it on like the Michigan 40. They get it, and at this point, Michigan's blown out. Like they have to put Tom Strobel on the field because Glasgow's out. They put Godin on the field. Godin does not do well in this game. I don't know if he's still not 100% and just had to tough it out, or if this was just a bad matchup for him.
Yeah, I mean, Indiana does have an excellent offensive line, a surprisingly excellent offensive line, but he also just did not look the same as he did before his injury.
And so they just keep pounding it at Michigan, and Michigan does at this point go on a 10-play drive. But then there are other two drives of the first half before the one-minute drill are a three and out and a two-play touchdown drive. So the defense is out there basically the whole first half, and they're coping. I mean, they're not doing great, but they hold Indiana to a couple of field goals.
Yeah, they're at least limiting scoring opportunities.
Yeah, and then at the end of the half, they give up a touchdown drive. And at that point, they just kind of cash in their chips. And in the second half, doesn't go so well to start, and then run. And it really reminded me of that Ohio State game from a couple years ago when they were putting out like people who I didn't even know existed. You know, they had like a version of Pipkins out there. They had a freshman version of Glasgow. They had Jabril Black playing nose tackle. And it just you couldn't hold up, and then defense kind of fell apart around it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, heading into this game, Michigan fans were kind of, you know, at least some of them were kind of looking at it like, well, the Glasgow injury stinks, but, you know, they've got Maurice Hurst. There's not much of a drop-off there, and that'll be fine. But like you pointed out in the game column, the real drop-off isn't from Glasgow to Hurst. It's from Glasgow to Matt Godin or Tom Strobel.
Right.
Because those are the guys who are actually seeing eating up those snaps.
Yes.
And those guys were overmatched.
Yes, and I mean I don't blame Tom Strobel. I always thought it was weird that Tom Strobel was listed as a defensive tackle. Yeah.
He was the backup right guard last week.
Yeah, I mean just a guy who's bounced around in his career, obviously has never really found a home. And suddenly he's thrust into action against a guy in Dan Feeney who the ESPN guy said that their scouts thought he was an All-American.
And it looked like it.
Yeah, it did. I mean they have all fourth and fifth years guys on that line, including the tight end. They have two guys who have NFL futures, and Michigan was throwing out guys who were either exhausted or not ready to cope. I do think we got kind of a reality check on how good Hurst is down in, down out against a really good defensive line.
Yeah, because he got knocked out of his gap a couple times. If you're trying to shoot upfield, you better make that play.
Yeah, and they managed to handle him. He couldn't quite press as much as Glasgow does. So a lot of the gaps that Howard were hitting weren't actually very big. I mean, Michigan was a step away from closing down a bunch of those cracks. But Hurst, he's a redshirt sophomore, and he's a little bit undersized. He just didn't have the power to glue those shut. And then when you're getting reached like that and the linebackers are getting hit by guys with great angles to block them, it's really tough for those linebackers to make plays.
Yeah, I mean, Morgan and Bolden, I don't think they either of them had particularly great games, but they were both dealing with a lot of traffic and they were eating blockers. And that's not all on them by any stretch.
No, it's just one of those things where I've seen a lot of people dump on the linebackers after this game, and I think there is some validity to that. Like, I think if you're a great linebacker, you get off more of those blocks, and you see some of those 15-yard runs be 5-yard runs. But those are still going to be 5-yard runs.
Yeah.
And you know, Morgan, I think, does a pretty good job of getting off blocks. He just was in a bad position a lot of the time. And then Bolden just – you see him get blocked and stay blocked way too often.
Yeah, he has just not developed the ability to shed that you really need in a type of game like that.
And then this was another game in which, you know, similar to what happened with Strobel, you know, this is a game in which the Mario Ojemudia injury really came home to roost as well, because Michigan had to put James Ross out there for a bunch of snaps as a buck, and we didn't see that go very well against Minnesota. It didn't go very well in this game either, but he's 230 pounds.
Yeah, it's understandable, but obviously Michigan's shorthanded. And also I think we saw why Ojemudia was clearly ahead of Royce Jenkins-Stone. Jenkins-Stone had a relatively productive game and made some really nice plays, but there were also a couple occasions where Jason Spriggs, who's Indiana's NFL-level left tackle, just sealed him off the edge way too easily and gave Howard the corner. And that happened a couple times and that was something that Ojemudia was specifically quite good at, was making sure that he didn't get edged. And that happened a few too many times on Saturday.
Yeah. And then that's how you get just beat up like that on the ground. And, you know, that comparison to the Ohio State game, I think is pretty accurate. You just can't really hang in there with the defense if you're getting blown off the ball up front.
Yeah. And with Indiana, I mean, they ran the ball 55 times, and I know that was an overtime, a double overtime game, and that adds to the numbers, but when you're just facing that sheer volume, that's going to wear you down.
Good things in this game were I thought Lewis was his usual self for
yes.
the most part.
Yes, he was.
He had two interceptions that got called back, one on a review. The other because Godin jumped off sides. Although I don't think that ball gets thrown if Godin can.
No, that was a clear free play. Just throw it up. I thought there was one play where Jeremy Clark just completely misplayed a back shoulder throw.
Yeah,
but I did think other than that he actually played pretty well. He had a couple pass breakups, and the stuff that was completed on him tended to be really short stuff that he was there to stop immediately.
Yeah, and then we saw Dylan O'Hill come back in this game because Thomas got knocked out. Thomas returned at the end of the game, which was a little bit odd.
Surprising, considering how serious his injury at first looked.
Yeah, but very good, obviously. And then Hill comes in, and he was instrumental in the fourth down stop that got Michigan the win, not just on that fourth down, but also on the two downs previous.
Yes.
So he's the guy in space when they try to run Sudfeld, and he makes it a form tackle against Nate Sudfeld, yes, but he also didn't give up
any leak yardage at all.
Yeah. And then on the previous play, he comes in from the side on a blitz and nails Howard. And of course, he is locked up one-on-one press coverage against the slot receiver, who's very quick. And he dominates that route. Like, he completely killed that route.
Yeah, he did the just enough clutching and grabbing to make sure that guy wasn't going to get off the line very well, and not enough to the point where an official was ever going to throw a flag in that situation. Yeah. He could not have played that. And then he managed to get his hand on the ball, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty textbook coverage.
And, you know, before Thomas went out, he did have one play where he reacted to a short throw and made a really nice tackle in space.
Yes.
So we've been worried about that second safety spot, not just for this year, but for next year for a couple weeks now. And I thought both those guys played very well in trying circumstances.
Yeah, I really think, you know, obviously we didn't see a ton of Thomas in this one, but it does seem like he is pretty much getting better on a weekly basis at this point. And that's quite encouraging for next year.
Yeah, it's one of those things where he kind of feels a little bit like Rudock, except you get another year from him where it's like, okay, he's getting it.
Yeah.
He's going to be a guy who we can maybe look at for next year. Chesson might have been a better answer there because he's very athletic, but never has really put it together. And then you're hoping that for that senior year, they're rock solid.
Yeah. Things seem to be clicking for some of those guys.
Yeah.
And it was great for Delano Hill to have the finish he had considering, you know, it's been a rocky few weeks.
It has been. I mean, whenever you lose your starting job, it's like, well, how are you going to respond when they come and call on you? And he responded as well as you possibly can.
So. Yeah, and they really, I mean, they were fortunate that Thomas came back too, because there was a brief period late where Wilson had to exit the game, and suddenly it could have been dire if they didn't have Thomas and Hill available.
Andre Pipkins, probably should not have induced him to transfer.
He'd be nice right now.
I mean, you don't know that at the time, but Michigan only has 82 guys on scholarship. So Pipkins obviously felt like he wasn't wanted and decided he was going to go somewhere else. And, you know, I think that was a mistake. I think it might have been an understandable one at the time because you have Monet still. You're really not looking at him to be a contributor at nose tackle. But
injuries do happen.
And nose tackle is a spot where you essentially have two starters, especially in today's modern tempo-tastic football. So, you know, I think that's something that is very much an artifact of – you know, he's not my guy. I didn't bring him in. I don't really know what I want. I might be going getting fifth-year transfers.
Yeah, and you're also, I mean, when you're kind of setting the tone with your first team, if you've got a guy who's butting heads with you and is also probably not going to see the field, you know, from a team chemistry standpoint, there might be some motivation there too.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like something that's going to keep continuing because, you know, if there's a guy who you think can contribute, then he's likely to want to do so. And I think that people who aren't likely to contribute are not going to want to stick around a Harbaugh team for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. We might be seeing some considerable attrition this offseason.
Yes, there's a fullback playing tailback right now that indicates where some of it might come from. We should talk game theory a little bit because Michigan managed to win this game in large part because they did a very good job at it. I mean, Wilson did a great job at it as well.
He did.
But Michigan gets the ball back with something like 49 seconds left in the first half. And how many coaches just take that to the locker room?
Brady Hoke.
But we've seen Jim Harbaugh look at any possession at the end of the first half as a potential scoring possession. He has thrown bombs when he's up 35-13. He did that intent to deceive play when he was up 35-13. He just wants points, and he's never, ever going to just look at that and be like, see ya.
Yeah, especially when you got that two-for-one chance.
Yeah.
Where you can score at the end of the half and then get the ball back to start the second.
And that didn't work out for Michigan, but they do go down the field, and they could have had a touchdown. One of the few things I thought Rudock did wrong all game is he really did have a little angle route for Perry that was open for a touchdown. I kind of understand why he might be afraid of throwing to Perry.
Indeed.
Just didn't go so well in the Utah game. But, you know, they got 3 points out of that, and that 3 points became critical later in this game. And then when they were on the verge of maybe giving that same drive to Indiana, you know, they get down to the one, and they run Sionahuma at the line. He gets stopped, and they just kind of wait. And there were a couple of people on Twitter that were like, what are you doing? And I'm like,
yeah, 'cause you could, I mean,
the exact right thing.
Yeah.
Because Michigan had two timeouts. All they had to do is wind the clock down a little bit and then run a play. And then they can use their whole playbook, not have to worry about run versus pass and get all four downs.
Yeah.
And that is, in fact, what happened. They needed all four downs. And unlike Minnesota, they did their clock management such that they would get them. And that got them to overtime, and that got them the win.
Yeah. When was the last time we saw a Michigan game in which both coaches managed game theory stuff pretty impeccably?
Wow, that's a good question. Probably like the BYU game because it just didn't matter in any way whatsoever.
That's true. But if we go back prior to this year, we're looking a long way back.
Well, I mean, like in like competitive games where there's like game theory stuff afterwards. Yeah, I don't know.
It's been a while.
It might be a while. I mean, Brady actually early in his career did some stuff that was good.
We did like his aggressiveness on fourth down his first year.
Yeah, because I think his aggressiveness on fourth down actually won that Ohio State game that year because they had a couple of fourth and go for it situations where they got it and they got touchdowns and that was the final margin.
So maybe 2011 Ohio State is the answer to that question.
I think it might be. Special teams, the punt return that happened, they're obviously getting a little bit shaky there, but that one...
Channing Stribling needs to wrap somebody up a little bit lower than the top of the head.
Yeah, that was such a... I don't even know what he was doing. And then Jenkinson kind of loses contain, and it's just like, ugh. So you can put all the guys in the right position, and they were in the right position.
Yeah, they were stringing that out to the point where that should have been dead in the water.
But then they gotta make the play.
Yeah.
And there's a Texas blog that I really like called Barking Carnival. And they've got a guy named Scipio Tex who writes for them.
Yes.
And he said that Texas was plagued by bad outcomes, not bad tactics in the West Virginia game.
That is a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah. And I thought that was a bad outcome with a good tactic. And then Michigan misses a field goal pretty much solely because the long snapper worm burners won back. We had a comment on the blog today that was like, you know, he's blown out. He had a 103 fever all week and he blew out his knee. So someone who knows this guy is just like, yeah, he's hanging in there.
He's fighting through some things right now.
But that's just, you know, again, one of those things. And Blake O'Neill did rescue another bad snap on a critical extra point.
Yeah, Michigan nearly had a just – I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, let's not think about that.
But I think we should give credit to Blake O'Neill for perhaps saving a disastrous special teams loss.
Yeah.
And maybe getting him to 1-1 in that category.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Neither do I. That came out of nowhere. briefly possessed.
All right. Gonna get to another break. And we will come back with our gimmicky top five on the other side, which is seemingly innocuous things that are in fact dangerous. We thought was appropriate after that. So this is MGo Radio presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. Ace, have you ever put together a tailgate?
No, I have not, actually.
Neither have I. My family does it. It's a lot of work. I leave an hour before the game because I don't want to help clean up. But if you don't have a family or like that kind of family, we have a solution for you. And that is tailgateconcierge.com. So get 10 people together, $40, they will set you up. Silverware, tables, a spot, real bathrooms. You know, for a little bit more, you get the food, the beer. They will go get that for you as well. You can just show up with 10 friends. It gets cheaper as you get more people. So if you've got a big event, it gets very, very cost effective. And you can just go and enjoy the game. Sounds pretty good, Ace, huh?
Yeah, no cleaning is pretty solid, in my opinion.
Both of our moms think the same thing. So go to tailgaterconcierge.com or call 888-301-2190. That's tailgaterconcierge.com at 888-301-2190. Ace, this is an ad break in a sports-themed show. What does that mean?
That means DraftKings.
It does mean DraftKings. So what I like about DraftKings is that you're not competing against the house. You're competing against other people. And as we know, other people are often Ohio State fans and therefore not very smart. DraftKings does a great job of projecting values and thus making the games fair. If you're listening to this later this week, the college football contest should be up. But for now, you can go to a free NFL contest for $1 million. $1 million. How many dollars is that, Ace?
1 million.
That's a lot of dollars. Just go to DraftKings.com, sign up with the code MGOBLOG.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well-known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, a fully equipped kitchen in every suite, and an indoor pool. They're also giving away $200 towards a stay to the winner of our pumpkin carving contest. Tag it hashtag MGOPumpkin and Seth will judge a winner. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshare Lending. By now you've probably read about my company on MGOBlog and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7.5.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have three really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
HomeSure Lending.
Good boys. HomeSure Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you. HomeSureLending.com. HomeSure, lending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue.
HomeSure Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
Sports Talk 1050 WTKA.
Welcome back to MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. I am Brian Cook. Ace Anbender is over here doing his Adam Scott impression. Come on, say something. Do it. You have to. You're on the radio. You got to.
I know I'm on the radio, but I'm sitting here shaking my head.
See, Adam Scott impression. Involuntary, constant Adam Scott impression.
It's There's no turning it off. There really is not.
All right, our gimmicky top five this week is seemingly innocuous things that are in fact dangerous. Ace, your number five.
Drew Dilio.
Good one. Very good one. The threat.
Threat, a nobody coming out of high school.
In terms of, that's a little harsh.
I mean, by recruiting standards. I mean, they were like, this guy isn't even ranked. I know it sounds harsh, but he literally was not ranked.
An unknown.
An unknown might have been a little bit better.
An unknown.
Slightly more tactful. Anyway, and a guy who was criminally underutilized.
Oh, God, yes.
And then comes through in that 2012 Michigan State game to, he was one of the biggest reasons Michigan actually managed to pull that one out.
Yeah.
And was just generally quite
very
reliable and dangerous
good, yeah.
for his career and just criminally underutilized and was not a nobody. He was not a nobody. My apologies, Drew Dilio.
God. My number five is Vontaze Burfict as a child.
Oh, good Lord.
Because, he's probably cute. 5 years old, Vontaze Burfict, and you would never know that he was going to develop into the most dangerous man in the NFL. And I still remember fondly his time at Arizona State, where
yes.
he was just
unchained, man.
Just, like multiple personal foul penalties on every drive, and the NFL's like, yeah, we'll take that guy.
Yeah, we like that.
I also think that there's a small chance that Burfict just randomly tackled people at 5 years old. And I'm not talking about like 5 year olds. I'm talking about like the mailman. Like just.
Oh, yeah.
And then like does a sack dance as the guy's like, oh, I slipped a disc. Help me.
UPS just won't deliver to his house anymore.
Yeah. Beware of Burfict.
Yes.
Ace, number four.
Driving anywhere in the city of Ypsilanti, which is my adopted home.
Really? What's so dangerous about Ypsilanti?
If you drive there at night, I've never gone anywhere on a road with any other people on it for more than 5 minutes without seeing somebody driving in pitch black with their lights off, like all of them.
What?
I don't know how to explain it. It is this remarkable phenomenon in Ypsilanti where people are not only generally bad drivers but also don't know how their lights work.
Maybe they do and they're just being sneaky.
It could be that. It could be that there's just not a single competent repairman in the entire town who's able to fix taillights that are out or something. But for some reason, every time. And it's like as soon as you cross over Carpenter from Ann Arbor on Washtenaw into Ipsy, the quality of driving drops by like 80%. It just all of a sudden people are cutting you off. People are driving 20 over or 20 under. People are pulling onto one ways the wrong way. It's just it's like Parents Weekend, except all the time in Ann Arbor, where people don't know where they're going and they're driving the wrong way down one way, and they just generally don't know how the whole town works.
I think I would have gone with Art Fair for like the worst traffic year of the year.
That's true. But I avoid Ann Arbor at all costs during Art Fair, so I just keep myself out of it.
My mom comes into town. Sorry, Mom. I don't want to like harsh your driving. Your driving's fine.
I was about to ask.
That's just a coincidence that she's in town and the driving skill drops off dramatically.
Definitely.
No, seriously. Trash talking to my mom.
No, I'm kidding.
Get with it, Adam Scott. My number four is QB slides.
Yeah, you've been on this stair for a bit now.
So I don't think that quarterbacks actually get protected. I don't think that they can adequately judge when someone is going to come in and hit them. So I think quarterback slides just put their heads in the wrong place to take a tackle.
Yeah, it is exactly where a defender is probably going to land if he is diving at you when you're upright and then you go down.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Bolden targeting call was complete crap. But even before that, Desmond Morgan had plowed Connor Cook in the head.
Yes.
And they weren't going to flag that because they don't flag that. Yeah. And we've seen Gunnar Kiel get completely annihilated.
Horrifying injury.
And have to leave the game on a slide. You know, we've seen Jake Rudock. It happened to him twice. We saw Anu Solomon of Arizona get knocked out of the game on a slide.
Yeah, there were a couple of the Pac-12 games this weekend.
And then I think it was Washington State's quarterback didn't get knocked out, but he took a brutal head-to-head hit.
He did.
And it's just like, man.
And they weren't flagged.
No, I mean, there's no flags ever coming in on these things. So you have to wonder, like, you know, if I am running downfield and I take a hit like a running back, is that going to go as badly for me as possibly getting wasted in the head?
Yeah, and what's scary with quarterbacks is that's how they've been taught to play for so long that is absolutely ingrained in those guys. And also, you know, the targeting rule is on the books. The quarterbacks are more protected than anybody else on the field by the letter of the law. So for them, you know, they expect not to get drilled when that's happening. But with the way that officials are calling targeting these days, which is not well at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it is dangerous.
It's just tough because, like, at what point is that a late hit? Because it really is unfair on linebackers because they're coming in to make a tackle like they've been taught to make a tackle. And all of a sudden, you know, the quarterback has just put his head right in the kill zone. And it's just – we saw Michigan change it up. And when Rudock burst out for his first long run, he just kind of, like, ran and then got tackled.
Yeah.
Notably, he did not get annihilated in the head.
It was much less scary.
Yeah. So giving yourself up as a quarterback is secretly super dangerous. Ace, your number three.
Legos. Cute childhood toy until you step on one and then you feel like you're about to die. You ever stepped on a Lego?
I have stepped on many Legos in my time, yes. Not recently, being not a person who has Legos just lying around, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you have Legos
why.
Just lying around?
No,
your house?
I don't really, but for some reason the thought just popped in. I think I've seen HBO constantly runs the Lego movie at this point, so I think I've just, it's been on my television enough in the last year where Legos are
on. It
kind of
feels like you have like some sort of really traumatic childhood experience that you're still carrying around with you.
If I do, it is very repressed.
At Thanksgiving, we used to have like Lego wars where we would just throw Lego pieces at each other, and once you know they have those like gray like road pieces that are like flat and very kind of frisbee like, and I almost took one of my cousin's eyebrows off with one of those.
Yeah, those have pretty sharp corners.
So, yeah, that wasn't really secretly dangerous. That was kind of obviously dangerous.
Yeah, that was just openly dangerous.
My number three is Triscuits.
I'm going to need further explanation.
Okay, they're whole wheat crackers. They only have like natural ingredients in them. They seem perfectly hale and healthy, and then you have a box of Triscuits, and you're like, oh, crap, I ate all of this box of Triscuits. And they go very well with, like, spinach dip and various other addictive substances that you should definitely not eat, like, a box of Triscuits of worth on top of it. Triscuits. Because, like, Doritos, you're like, oh, these are Doritos. I should only have a small number of Doritos. But with Triscuits, it's just like, oh, I can eat all of these.
Yeah, I just eat whatever I want.
Yeah, you do. Well, you've had a
I need to.
Yeah, you kind of, you know, whatever.
believe it or not, no food made my list.
Well, yeah, I'm like, should I make fun of his terrible disease? And I'm like, I'm going to take a pass.
I set you up for it.
Yeah, you did.
You did. It's not a horrible disease. It's quite treatable.
Well. Annoying disease?
Yeah, I think it has been quite annoying.
Ace, you're number two.
Every tweet I've ever composed about Michigan State. Because, man, those people are easily offended.
Oh, just like easily innocuous on your part.
Yes, like I think like this is clearly a joke.
Yes.
Like, nobody could possibly take a lot of offense to this. And then just all the fire emojis and the mentions.
Well, and then, you've obviously just adapted. Now you're just like, I'm just going to troll.
The last month really, it was a bit of a turning point for me in the troll game.
Yeah, right? The secretly great thing about the Juggalo thing is I don't actually like think that. It just drives people crazy.
They go nuts.
They are insane about it.
I think all of the Only Colors has unfollowed everybody involved with MGO Blog at this point because of the constant Juggalo talk.
Well, you know. Mission accomplished. My number two is wheel routes.
Are those even seemingly innocuous? Because those terrify the heck out of me.
Well, given the way that people cover them, they are innocuous. Yes. Because it's like, oh, it's just Sione Huma leaking out of the backfield. Oh, it's just Michigan State's fullback leaking out of the backfield. Oh, it's just a tailback. We'll cover him with a linebacker. It'll be fine. And so often it is not fine. So from the perspective of the defensive coordinator, the wheel route seems innocuous. From the perspective of Twitter, the wheel route is kind
the
of
greatest the greatest thing to ever happen.
The basis of offense in this country.
Well, remember that or defensive pass interference.
Remember that Illinois game with like where just wheel route, like everybody?
That's all I see when I close my eyes and think about that game.
I actually see a circus, a literal circus.
With Gerg just juggling stuffed beavers.
Ace, your number one.
Spike Albrecht.
Oh, damn it.
Did we do it again?
My number one is a little bit more specific. It is Spike Albrecht in an NCAA title game.
Fair enough.
Because there has never been anything more like, oh, this guy's coming in for Trey Burke.
A 12-year-old child has found a jersey and is now coming in as the point guard.
Yes. There's never been a bigger disconnect from accomplishment and expectation than those 15 minutes of that NCAA title game.
And I do want to shout out the Michigan Daily for heading into this Michigan basketball season. Their main Simon Kaufman wrote a really great feature on Spike Albrecht, and the photos for it were Spike alongside three adorable Moppets who were the tiniest one looked a lot like Spike at 5 years old and had these shorts that must have been maybe not even a foot long and were Fab Five level baggy on this tiny little child. And it was a really great look.
Representation.
And it was just to see Spike next to them where it's the only time Spike has looked somewhat adult like, but he, coming out firing today. I guess,
yeah, you are. God.
Got to get it all in. I have to leave in like 5 minutes,
you
man.
You do. You could just not say the terrible things.
That's true. But that's so much less fun.
Real quick, we got about 5 or 6 minutes before you got to go. Impressions from the Northern Michigan game?
I think the big thing to come out of that was that Aubrey Dawkins is going to be just fine. I mean, he had a bit of a rough first game, but was lighting it up from outside, finishing pretty spectacularly. He had a one-handed tip slam of Duncan Robinson, missed three-pointer, and then also had a really nice, I think it was his first bucket, was an off-the-dribble little pull-up floater in the lane, and that's a new part of his game. And if he can create off-the-dribble, then Michigan suddenly has four guys in their starting lineup who can potentially create their own offense, and that's something. So that was big. So the other takeaways were that DJ Wilson should probably be the backup center.
Behind
Ricky Doyle.
Okay.
Ricky Doyle has not started yet this year. I assume this is like last year where they were putting Mark Donnell out there to see if they could get something out of him.
Yeah.
And so far, like last year, the returns have not been great on that front.
No, I actually got the opportunity to watch that game last night, and it was kind of like he didn't actually give up the buckets, but he was giving up basically layups to that 6'6 guy.
Yeah, 6'6, like 280 pounds, and looked like, out of shape and not a dangerous guy. And, I've gone back and looked at his previous stats. This is not a dominant post player.
Sure.
Donnell was getting worked. So I think, and Wilson was also providing a lot of upside in terms of he can protect the rim quite well. His passing from the top of the key was great in this game. He had three assists, and he should have had a fourth, but Dawkins got fouled on a layup attempt. And I think the upside, it'll be interesting to see how he handles more size, and we'll get a slightly better idea, I think, of that tonight because Elon does actually have a couple center-sized people, and Michigan hasn't really faced that yet.
No.
So hopefully we'll get a better idea of that. I actually like Wilson more at the five than the four because he doesn't look very comfortable defending on the perimeter yet.
No, he looks very much above athletic, above average athleticism for the position at the five. But at the four, he's a little bit slow when he's tracking smaller guys.
Yeah, having to go laterally is a little tough.
That might be less of a problem against actual D1 teams, because a lot of these teams are like, the you know, we've got the 6'7 guy at center and everybody else is 6'3. So that might be.
Yeah, you're guarding a bunch of little dudes running around that you're just not used to guarding. So, there are some things. And I thought the offense was also just clicking better in this game. He was running mostly through Caris LeVert, who was doing a nice job of not dribbling the air out of the basketball and actually facilitating offense, I thought. And then when he needed to just take over, he did a fantastic job of that.
I like Caris's like active hands.
Yes.
So he got his hands on probably five or six balls. Just, you know, he's 6'7", he's lanky, and it's just one of those things where he hasn't had the steal numbers that I think someone with his body type should have. And I'm hoping that we get a lot more active kind of stuff on the perimeter from him.
Yeah, and I think it's not only just going to be him. I mean, John Beilein talked about after the game how this was a real point of emphasis for this team was even if you're not necessarily looking at the ball, just getting your hands up and passing lanes and just disrupting passes. And Michigan ended up with a bunch of steals in that game. Spike Albrecht, I mean, he's done it before, but he jumped a couple passing lanes real quickly. And there was, even when they weren't getting steals, there was a play where Northern tried to skip pass to a three-point shooter who was pretty open on the opposite wing. And Cam Chapman, who's a pretty lanky dude, had his back to the pass but just kind of threw his hands up in the air. Ball tips off the back of his hand, and it slows the ball way down. Takes forever to get to the three-point shooter, and Michigan's able to recover on that guy.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, it's not going to show up in the box score, but if Michigan is, you know, the steals do, obviously, and Michigan's been excellent at converting those into points on the other end. But I think Michigan can really – I think they're going to be more focused on creating turnovers and just general havoc on defense this year because of the length that they have, because they can also – with that length, recover a little bit more if someone takes a chance and misses.
Yeah, and one of the things about having Walton back is that he's really good at facilitating transition.
Yes.
So if you do get those deflections and you get in the open court, you're gonna have a good time, especially when you have, I don't know, Aubrey Dawkins there for tip dunks.
Yeah, and you know, people were a little disappointed because Walton did not have much of an impact at all in the box score, and I think he only finished with one assist in this game. But him leaking, he had a bunch of hockey assists. I mean, his first pass on the fast break was on point. He was getting out quickly. He was looking to run off misses. And it was also nice, especially when Wilson was in there at the five, because when he's there, everybody on that team can run. So they were leaking out well. And Michigan could be a pretty fun transition team this year.
Yes, they should be. So they take on Elon in about an hour. And now you have to leave us to go cover that game.
Indeed.
But we will talk to you next week. I say that to Jamie.
I know. And then now
you got it.
Yeah.
All right. On the other side, we're going to talk some hockey with Anthony Ciotti, who can be MGO J-Bug or MGO House, whichever one he wants. This is MGO Radio presented by Underground Printing and Moe's.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom-printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages $90,000. It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
Ace, this is an ad break in a sports-themed show. What does that mean?
That means DraftKings.
It does mean DraftKings. So what I like about DraftKings is that you're not competing against the house. You're competing against other people. And as we know, other people are often Ohio State fans and therefore not very smart. DraftKings does a great job of projecting values and thus making the games fair. If you're listening to this later this week, the college football contest should be up. But for now, you can go to a free NFL contest for $1 million. $1 million. How many dollars is that, Ace?
$1 million.
That's a lot of dollars. Just go to DraftKings.com, sign up with the code MGOBLOG.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well-known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, a fully equipped kitchen in every suite, and an indoor pool. They're also giving away $200 towards a stay to the winner of our pumpkin carving contest. Tag it hashtag MGOPumpkin, and Seth will judge a winner. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Sports Talk 1050 WTKA.
Welcome back to MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. Next time, can we get the old Hockey Night in Canada theme, guys? That would be awesome. So we welcome in Anthony Ciotti right now. Anthony Ciotti is a longtime friend of mine, so I'm totally doing the Simmons thing. But he's also one of the smartest guys I know about hockey. So we're going to talk some Michigan hockey. They're 5-1-1 early in the season. Say hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being my friend. But that 5-1-1 is you know, a little bit hollow because of the competition they've played. I mean, you said they were 14th in RPI?
Yeah, they're 14th. They went up from 20th after the game on Friday, after the completion of the weekend's games.
I mean, that just kind of lets you know that right now RPI is very jittery because there's not a whole lot of data in the system. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Michigan at 5-1-1 to be 14th in the RPI is not really a good sign because they're going to lose some games. I mean, they've got a big one against BU this weekend.
They got two, yes.
Two against BYU, yeah. BU this weekend. And that's going to be the toughest team they face so far. Mm-hmm. But how tough is BU, really?
Well, I mean, they made the finals last year and lost to Providence. But I don't – like, they had Eichel.
Yeah, Jack Eichel, the second pick in the last draft.
Right. It was a Hobie Baker winner. And with him on the ice, I think they were around, like, 60% possession. And without him, they were, like, in the low 40s.
And those are like, really extreme numbers, right? Like, yeah. You don't get much better or worse than that as a hockey team.
No, that's, like – that would be, like – 60 is like really extreme. Like that doesn't actually really even happen too much in the NHL. It would happen more in college because of like the disparity in talent.
Yeah.
You know, Michigan's doing that a lot this year. I think they're at like 59 overall as a team. But like without him on the ice, they were like a really, really bad team last year. So this year they're right in the middle. I think they're about 500. They do have quite a talented roster. They have eight draft picks, I believe. You know, they're probably going to be the second most talented team Michigan plays this year behind Minnesota.
Which is depressing.
Yes, because their record is probably not going to be that good. They don't seem to have, you know, have it all together. The record is quite middling right now. I believe they are, they're like 5-5 or something like that. A lot of teams have played a lot more games than Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan's also already had two bye weeks. So, and then they played just a one-off against Niagara. So, I mean, I don't mind the bye weeks early in the season. Let you get some practice time under your belt. Doesn't interfere so much with football, but mm-hmm. You know, you and I have watched this team over the past few years, and it feels pretty much like the same team where, mm-hmm. You know, they're very talented individually, but they're somehow less than the sum of their parts.
Yes, I think I was thinking about that today about are they better than last year? I don't think we can tell yet because they haven't really played anybody. I think we'll know a lot more after this weekend. I think overall they seem to have a little bit more depth at forward and maybe three full decent lines. And this defense, I believe, has a higher floor than last year.
They're basically the same crew except older on defense.
Right. They have Ciccone and Boca as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they are a little bit younger, but I believe, like I said, they seem to be a little bit more sound. Although they do give up quite a bit of, you know, odd man rushes and breaks.
They've given up multiple goals, and I think in three or four games already on odd man rushes, which is mm-hmm. It's not the sign of a team that's really well organized, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think Friday wasn't it like four or maybe five odd man rushes overall? I mean, between the 3-on-1, 2-on-1,
they didn't give up that many goals on them, but there were a couple.
Yeah.
And it's just against a team like Niagara, who you can just look at them and you're like, man, they don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not like they're creating those chances. It's just they happen to get them because Michigan is very sloppy.
Yeah, I think a lot of it happens at the opposition blue line in transition.
Yeah.
The defenseman will get caught. The other defenseman won't pick up the man. A lot of times it's back check issue. I think there's a few different issues that they face in transition. You know, honestly, it's nothing that can't be cleaned up. But, you know, as you were saying with the last few years, it's to be determined if it will. You know, the last few years don't really seem to indicate that it might not change.
You're much more fiery when you're not on the radio. I've been worried about having you on because there's FCC stuff going on, and you're very well behaved so far.
Well, Dave shot me up with a tranquilizer before.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah. Move the mic a little closer to your mouth, though.
Sure.
We don't know that much about the hockey team yet, but like, you know, who are the guys who are really sticking out to you as maybe guys who could step forward and maybe make this a tournament season?
I think as definitely Kyle Connor. So he's been playing wing primarily. He was drafted as a center. He's probably going to play center in the NHL.
He was drafted 14th?
14th or 15th, I believe. Yeah, by the Jets. The Jets actually traded up to get him because he dropped a little bit. He was supposed to be in the fringe of the top 10. So he dropped. The Jets traded up to get him. He's been very good. He's a tied for the leading scorer, I believe, with
Cooper Merrity, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or so Marotti.
Their top three scorers are freshmen because Warren is third.
That third line, which is Calderon, Marotti, and Warren, we both saw them at the opening night and we're like, these guys are good.
Yes.
And it's just one of those things where, you know, sometimes guys come in really prepped to play and they – honestly, they bring an energy that I don't think we see from everybody out there. And by everybody,
I definitely think they move really well together. They seem to play like they've been playing together for quite a while rather than just a few games. I think they're going to be a matchup problem on third line. I think that's part of the reason why they're scoring so much.
I think they're the second line, honestly. Like,
right. But as far as the defensive matchups are concerned, you know, as freshmen, you might not want them matching up against other teams. Top players as they start to play better competition, so having them as a third line will bode quite well. It's hard to say what their first and second line really is. It kind of goes back and forth. It was the Connor line at the beginning, centered by Nieves and with Selman. Conference line has been kind of second, but now first.
That was always the first line, like,
right? Yeah,
I think. We've seen Mark Dinal start the first couple basketball games, and I felt that's kind of the same motivation that you would have to have Nieves on your notional top line because it's like, all right, this is on you. You got to go get it. And I don't think that's really worked out with Nieves. He hasn't really – he just seems like the same player. He's always been kind of a peripheral guy, great vision passing, but you know, just doesn't create the kind of scoring opportunities I think you expect a guy who was a second-round pick to create, especially as a senior.
Yeah, he's definitely a lot more of a perimeter player. Like we've talked about, he's got really good hands and good skills, and it's kind of disappointing because, you know, he probably should get in the shooting lanes a little bit more. He's really low on the team as far as shot attempts go. Actually the lowest, I believe, despite, you know, even though he's got only four games played because he missed a couple, but he's still on a shot attempts per game average, which that data is out there. Like, he's one of the lowest on the team. And I think that as the season unfolds and as they start playing tougher competition and as Connor gets more acclimated, I think he'll end up moving to center is what I think will end up happening, you know, once they get kind of towards the end of the first semester.
So he can kind of drive that line a little bit more.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll see how it works out at the World Juniors, because obviously Connor's going to go. I would assume Wierenski's going to go as well. We'll see how they work and, you know, against really, really good competition. I'll be excited for that. But coming back into the Big Ten season, you know, starting January, it'll be really interesting to see. But I do think, like, he'll kind of end up as a center. And it's smart for them to, you know, start Connor off, on the wing.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you never really know what you're going to get from freshmen. And I think Michigan's been fortunate because they actually only brought Marotti in because they lost Dylan Larkin and they lost Andrew Kopp. And he was originally supposed to come in next year. Yeah, but he had a really good USHL season. He got drafted, and it's just one of those. Sometimes a guy comes in and he doesn't really make an impact, but both Marotti and Warren and Connor have. So that's a definite boost.
they've kind of hit the jackpot with their freshmen this year.
Yeah, which hasn't always happened.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, the defense core, like, up and down. Like, Downing still makes a number of bad decisions a game. You know, that was kind of his rep coming in. Like, he was actually touted as a guy who could be a first-round pick, and then he had such an uneven final year in the USHL. And then, you know, we've seen kind of that continue at Michigan, and that's kind of – Is that going to get better at this point? I mean, he's a junior.
I'm not sure. I went back and looked at his draft profile, and that was kind of the knock on him at the time. I had watched him play with the U17 or U18, one of the tournaments that they had in Ann Arbor,
yeah.
And he was outstanding. You know, and that was against, you know, younger competition. He was also one of the biggest guys on the team at that time. You know, he probably had his growth spurt a little bit earlier, and that might have helped him. But yeah, I mean, he's definitely on the first pair now, nominally, and. No, they're doing an all right job. It would be Werenski, wouldn't it?
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but, you know, he's doing an all right job. I'm not sure. As a junior, you probably are what you are at this point.
Yeah.
I think I have a lot more optimism with Boca and Ciccone, you know, moving forward. I like Boca so far. You know, they're going to make mistakes as freshmen. But, you know, they've definitely, I think, been solid. And, you know, Cutler, Martin, Piazza, they do have some depth. Werenski would be their only guy like right now that I would see playing in the NHL at some point though.
Well, Cutler Martin's an interesting guy. I really liked him last year cause he was physical. Mm-hmm. He's got a great shot and, he just seemed a little bit uneven and really haven't seen that much from him this year to indicate that he might be taking a step forward to be like a really solid number one defender.
Yeah, I agree. We haven't seen him too much. And also, you know, they've been dressing seven defensemen, so it's the ice time's a little bit more spread out.
Yeah, that's so strange because they were doing that when Nieves was out, and he's back now, and they're still going with that. And it's just you and I have been kind of complaining for years that it feels like Michigan doesn't play their top guys enough.
Right.
And, you know, if their 12th forward is Nico Porikos or whoever – like maybe that makes sense just to roll with those 11 guys, but it is a little bit odd just from a like because you go out there and it's like okay which line is this now because there's right. always someone else.
Yeah, they've been double shifting guys and taking turns. So when they have that fourth line going, it'll be Connor one shift, it'll be Nieves one shift. You know, they'll Selman one shift. So they'll rotate those guys in. I think it's a good idea. I mean, they only play two games a week, so you know how I feel. I think they should. Kind of ride their horses a little bit more, especially, you know, when they had like Truba and Merrill and whatnot, you know. I think that maybe not so much with this roster on defense, but, you know, typically, you know, especially maybe at forward as well, especially with how good Connor and the Comfort line is. And
yeah, I mean, they seem to go three lines deep with the scoring, so it doesn't really bother me so much that it seems like they haven't put all the weight on some guys. But sometimes, I mean, you had Jacob Truba here. It's like
– yeah. They didn't really start riding him till like late January, February that season when they started getting desperate.
That guy should have played like 40 minutes a night.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and when Merrill came back that year, they were, you know, they were doing really well. And that's when they started to really start only playing four defensemen.
So your goalie, goalie play this year has been uneven, to say the least. And, I mean, do you see one of those guys having an advantage or the other long term? Or is it just kind of like chips fall where they may?
I kind of think it's a chips fall where they may. Instance. They're both capable. You know, we've seen Nagelvord get hot. He got hot enough to get drafted and he had an outstanding year his freshman year.
In about 20 games, which is nothing statistically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's a blip on the radar, but it's worth a fourth round pick.
Sure.
You know, honestly. And Racine, he's gotten hot in spurts. You know, he carried the team through the Big Ten tournament last year. He got really hot half of his freshman year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if he can get hot, that'll be really good. I do think that's good to kind of rotate them as it is or, you know, split time, however they see fit. I don't really like starting back-to-back on especially an early game the second day like they did against Robert Morris because they have two competent goalies, you know. So
yeah, but that's what Red's done for 20 years until the last three or four.
Right, but they had Turco and Shields. And,
yeah.
You know, so I think it's a little bit of a different – it's a little bit of a different game now these days too. You know, so – but I think they're both – you know, I don't see the complaints, to be honest with you. You know, their save percentage is low, but I think it's because they have a tendency as a team to give up really bad chances.
That they do.
Yeah. And, you know, two-on-ones are the most difficult shot for a goalie stop. So and if you're seeing three or four of those a game, you're probably going to get scored on once or twice. You know, and if things go bad, it's going to be three times. You know, and so you know, breakaways, that kind of thing. And it's hard when you're standing around for quite a while as well to face shots like that. So I don't necessarily think they're a problem. And if you're going to list bad things about the team, like, they would be kind of far down the list, I think. They're consistent. I mean, they're not going to be stealing games on a regular basis like Hildebrand or, you know, like Ryan Miller back in the day. But, you know, they're good enough to win with.
Could have gone with Al Montoya there instead of Ryan freaking Miller.
Well, I just remember the frustration on the other side. Right?
Yeah,
Montoya was fantastic. And, you know, they've had great goaltending in the past. I definitely think the game's changed a little bit. But those guys are guys you can win with, I believe, especially as they're a little bit older now too.
So what did you think about my idea about new change to the rules in hockey where you have to – change goalies on the fly once a period, otherwise you get a breakaway shot against you. That's a great rule change.
I consider myself a little bit more of a purist.
you don't think that's in vain with the spirit of hockey?
I want to come back on the show, so I
well, you know, you can give, yeah, you can call a spade a spade.
Well, we've had discussions about this so much about the way to improve the game, and I don't think widening the nets is necessarily the answer.
I see,
or like other things like that.
I think that, you know, you just need to do it a little bit because you see so many teams taking that Michigan State approach, where they're just putting all five guys in front of the goalie and daring you to find the way through. Like, I think hockey is more entertaining when you actually have to have a reason to pressure the points. Because then you have to move the puck. The other guys have more freedom. And it's just one of those things where, you know, right now, if you're playing 5-on-5, there's just not enough room on the ice. So how do you create more notional room? You can either expand the ice surface itself, which I do support.
Yes.
I love those games where Michigan goes to Minnesota and just – it's just a skill fest. It's glorious. I just love the fact that – it's like the only good part about the Big Ten, really, is the fact that Michigan gets to go to Minnesota every year.
Yeah, we never got to watch those games at Northern because they play in an Olympic rink as well. You know, but, yeah, I totally agree. And the World Juniors on the years where they're in Europe is awesome. Olympics, the time zone in Europe is awesome. And, yeah, I think the obvious answer is to widen the rink. I can see it.
You know, but that's something that, you know, you need to build a new building to do that, basically. And that's not something that is ever going to change really quickly.
Take out a row or two of seats, but no one's going to do that either. Yeah. You know? But, you know, to the extent of widening the nets, maybe, you know, I've seen shaving the insides off so the inside is square, where everything off the post would go.
That's
in.
Just widening the net, though.
In a way, yeah. But your idea is to widen it by the length of a post.
And, yeah, so everything that goes off the post is now a goal.
Yeah.
And that's like –
that's a better solution than making the goalie equipment smaller, because that's not going to make the goalies worse, I don't think.
No, and like, that's one of those things where, you know, you're never going to actually fix that. Like, the goalie equipment thing is like cracking down on contact in basketball, where it'll work for a few months or something, and then it'll just eventually go back to what it was.
The game wasn't designed for goalies as athletic as this. I mean, back in the day, it was just dudes who stood there with – you know, leather and deer hair. And it was, you know, 10 pounds per pad. Like, Trevor Kitt's pads from like the late 90s were like 10 pounds each, 11 pounds each. And now they're like 4.5, 5 pounds. And that's just the leg pads. You know, the chest protector has gotten lighter. You know, the skates have gotten lighter. So it's just easier. And the goalies are more athletic now. They're specially trained. Like, a lot of teams didn't even have goalie coaches in the NHL in the 80s. Yeah,
that's
so
amazing.
Right, so I think the game just kind of evolved away from the size of ice and whatever that it is now, and adjustments will have to be made. I don't necessarily think the sport is worse off, like, as a pure, like, someone who enjoys watching hockey. Like, I'll watch Florida against Dallas. So, I mean, maybe I'm the wrong guy, but
yeah, you're way on one side of the scale. I just, you know, I would feel like I would like hockey as a sport more if I felt like, you know, going into a third period down a goal wasn't just very close to a death sentence. Like, you know, it's just there's so many chances, but so many of them are half chances, you know, and it doesn't really feel like the prop. Like, for soccer, I think the amount of scoring in soccer makes sense for that game.
Right.
But I think for the NHL, I like a game that ends 5-4.
Well, in soccer, the buildup is mostly in two-thirds, you know, the middle two-thirds. And in hockey, it's closer to the net, you know. So it doesn't make sense where it would be 3-2. I totally agree with you. And I also think that teams are going to start figuring out a way to get goals as well.
Are they?
You know?
I mean, they've been trying for 20 years now, ever since the left-wing lock came in. Like,
I think so. I mean, I think the game's getting faster. The players are getting more agile. I mean, we're seeing it with the Red Wings and Michigan to an extent. Like when they come up, you know, they're scoring a ton. But when they come up against better teams, they have a little bit of a trouble. But, you know, the Red Wings can't score at even strength because they don't use their defensemen the way they need to. And a lot of teams are starting to use their defensemen. So you're seeing a lot more speed and action in the neutral zone.
Yeah.
That's entertaining in a different way. Like, you're not seeing the goals. But I think the game's gotten a lot faster and a lot more entertaining in the neutral zone because in the 90s, it was just all plugged up, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that also kind of feels like hockey is unfortunately random right now,
mm-hmm.
where you can outshoot a team by 40 and sometimes the goalie is just going to steal that for you. And if, you know, save percentages came down to 900 or 880, yeah. then at that point, it seems like the more deserving team wins. Like, you go to the NHL playoffs these days, and it doesn't really matter what the seeds are.
Right.
And that feels frustrating to me.
Yeah. You can have a goalie steal a series. Like, they're not going to steal four, but they might steal one or two. And that kind of messes things up early on.
Yeah.
You know, where Detroit almost beat Tampa because Mrazek was out of his mind last year. And that would have been, you know, for the sport, a bad thing because Tampa was one of the best teams, and they would have not made it out of the first round.
I just feel like, you know, the goalie is simultaneously too important and not important enough because, look, nowadays you can get a guy who has NHL league average save percentage for nothing off the street, which makes it very frustrating when, you know, you sign Nikolai Kabupulin for a ridiculous contract for 4 years when he's 36.
Right, or Hammond comes in off the street and takes Ottawa to the playoffs last year. Or
right,
like
it's
that.
Just like, everybody kind of seems to be averaged out. Mm-hmm. So I feel like at this point you want to – how do you get the Hasek type again? I think you kind of have to make it so that there's more net to cover and there's
I can't
more
disagree with that logic, but yeah. as a goalie, I can't.
Agree. You can't condone.
I can't agree either.
Can't condone that at all. So the Big Ten this year, you know, they came out, they had an absolutely terrible start, but Wisconsin upset number one North Dakota, so that's a bit of a boost. And this is really important for Michigan because most of their schedule is going to be against these teams, and their non-conference schedule has nobody on it who's currently in the tournament. Probably won't have anyone on it who's going to be in the tournament except maybe BU.
Mm-hmm.
And without that schedule strength, they're going to have a really, really good record to actually make the tournament as an at-large. So have we seen a little bit of improvement in the league in the last few weeks?
Michigan is by far and away the highest ranked, so they're 14th. The second is Penn State at 29.
This is an RPI.
Yeah, an RPI. And I'm sure, you know, pairwise seems to kind of mimic this to an extent.
These days, the pairwise is very close to RPI.
Yeah,
so
third is Minnesota at 34. Fourth is Wisconsin at 35.
That's terrible.
Ohio State and Michigan State are farther down, 42 and 47. Actually, you know, Arizona State is higher than Ohio State right now.
Arizona State, of course, is a first-year team.
They swept Lake State this weekend.
Yeah, they did. They're an independent. They swept Lake State at Lake State.
Yeah.
And so for Arizona State to be above those teams in RPI is just – I mean, Michigan, they're, unless someone gets hot, Michigan isn't going to play a tourney team all year?
Most likely.
God.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Robert Morris is the best team they've played, and that's 18.
That's
and Robert Morris is in Atlantic, so
they're in the LA Hockey, so they're going to drop like a rock,
right? So it's you know, it's kind of all coming down to the conference tournament, which unfortunately is in Minneapolis
and is months away. So why even bother playing the intervening season?
Yeah.
I mean, if they are just absolutely dominant against this schedule, they can get in. But that's what it's going to take.
Right.
The malpractice of this non-conference schedule is just. I mean, they can't. They got. I'm just really frustrated because. You know, anyone who saw the Big Ten last year and saw that they didn't fire Tom Anastas, they saw they didn't fire Mike Eaves, and they saw that Minnesota was losing a ton.
Yeah.
Like, should have been like, man, we need to load up in the non-conference, and they come out with this schedule.
Yeah, because if you do bad, you can still win the conference tournament, right? So you're covering your own.
Yeah. I mean, you give yourself a shot at the at-large, and right now it's hard to – I mean, Michigan is at 14 right now, and – and it's going to be really tough to move up.
It's hard to imagine them having done much better so far. You know, 5-1-1 is really good. I mean, they kind of did play poorly in the game they lost, but it's a reasonable expectation for a schedule. Like 5-1-1 is very good, and they're going to have to kind of mimic this the rest of the way.
And that's a lot of pressure for a team that gives up a ton of 2-on-1 goal.
Yeah, because that's how you can lose a game real tight. You know, if you go on a cold streak, you know, your power play's not working, and you give up a bad goal, like that's. it's going to be all she wrote, and it's bad. You know, it's bad for single elimination hockey, but it's also bad when you have to play really well for 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Michigan is kind of in a single elimination hockey tournament already.
Yeah,
which is brutal. And I mean, obviously, Hackett's done a lot of stuff that's been great with the revenue sports, and hockey is kind of in that zone where I'm not sure if he's paying it that much attention. So you still kind of have this kind of Brandon after effect where the only thing they're looking at is the bottom line.
Right.
So you get a ton of home games when the RPI overvalues road games.
Probably low cost home games too.
Yeah, and you're bringing in teams that are just the cheapest without really any recognition of the fact that, for one, it'd be nice if Michigan had a good home series for the season ticket holders, and for two, you're really putting yourself behind the eight ball when it comes to making the tournament.
Yes, definitely. And you were saying something about how playing more home games than road games kind of skews the RPI as well. Like,
it does.
Penalizes you. So I think that can be really dangerous. I don't see it as something that has to exist forever. Like, they should fix it this offseason. You know, they should take a look and see what they need.
You know what my idea is, right? Like, so there are seven teams in Michigan, and now they're spread across three different conferences. And what you should do is you should probably grab Bowling Green, but if Notre Dame wants to do it, you grab Notre Dame. And you put them in two groups that are like World Cup-style groups. And then you have them play each other. And for conference teams, they could move conference games earlier in the year to make sure that doesn't occupy too many non-conference games for them. And then you replace the GLI with the finals of this tournament.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. And every year you've got some very solid programs. I mean, Northern's pretty good. Tech's good now. Western is good.
Ferris is good more often than not, too.
Yeah, and like, this is a base level of competition that is above Atlantic Hockey. Mm-hmm. And that might revive the GLI, which has really kind of fallen off since the mid-90s.
Definitely.
And it's just one of those things where you want to play for stuff. And I think that those would be meaningful games for everybody involved. Help you sell tickets. It helps kind of bring back that kind of CCHA feel that I thought was a real positive for college hockey.
Yeah, you would have to have three games. So it'd be two groups of four.
You have it'd be six games. It'd be serious because you can't go to Tech for one game, you know.
Oh, that's true.
So, for Michigan and Michigan State, having six non-conference games that are dedicated to this tournament is no problem at all. Mm-hmm. But if you're in the WCHA, I think they're playing 28 conference games. Mm-hmm. Now, there would be teams that would – like Lake State would play Northern early in the year, and that would count for this, and it would also count as a conference game.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So, like, that I think would be something that would really, really revitalize both non-conference schedules and the GLI. But
I think just fan interest in the area as well.
Yeah, it'd just be cool, you know.
Yeah.
And Minnesota should do the same thing too, because they haven't played North Dakota in a while. They haven't played all these teams, and it's just like, dude – have like a cup competition for yourself, like EPL.
The creation of the Big Ten kind of lost all the regional aspect of Minnesota and Michigan.
But I thought that was necessary because, you know, you saw there was a 12-team CCHA, there was a 12-team WCHA. And if there was ever going to be a team that wanted to add hockey, they were just doomed because you could play in College Hockey America until that ceased existing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just no – like, is Arizona State – do they add a program – if it's just the CCHA and the WCHA?
No, because now they have a few different options to get.
Right. Any one of the three Western conferences will probably accept them gladly. And now you've got a foothold in Arizona and you can expand the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that was just never going to happen until the Big Ten came around. And it sucks that it sacrificed so much about what we loved about college hockey. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that you can reclaim a lot of that with these little tournament competitions.
I agree. Something like that should definitely happen.
All right. And you also agree about expanding the nets. You got to talk. It's the radio. When there's dead silence, it's not
I'm
fun.
Just shaking my head. All right. Is listening.
Yes. All right. We got to get to a break. This is MGO Radio presented by Underground Printing and Moe's.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom-printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
In 1934, a salesman from Champion Sportswear walked into Moe's Sports Shop. There, he teamed up with George J. Moe to create the very first University of Michigan branded shirt. After seeing the high demand for this product, Champion went to the other Big Ten schools with the same proposal, and the collegiate apparel industry was born. Moe Sports Shops is celebrating 100 years of outfitting the Michigan faithful. Visit us at our original 1915 location at 711 North University or online at 100years.mo. That's 100years.moe.
Sports Talk 1050 WTKA.
I think it's from The Jerk.
Welcome back to MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. Mission, of course, has a critical conference matchup coming up this weekend against the Penn State Nittany Lions. So we thought we would bring in a Black Shoe Diaries person, editor of Black Shoe Diaries, Carrie Green. How are you doing, Carrie?
I'm good. I'm the managing editor. They let me run the place, if you can believe it.
I cannot believe that.
I know. a girl actually no. running a sports
No,
book.
A Penn State graduate running a sports book.
Oh, thanks so much.
So we're off to a stirring start. So Penn State has had a really interesting year. They obviously start off pretty poorly, but they've recovered to be 7-3. You know, year two of Franklin coming off the sanctions, especially with that 2014 offensive line, it kind of feels like a little bit of a recovery. What do you think the attitude around the program and the fan base is right now?
Well, I think the attitude around the program and the fan base are kind of opposite, right? I think overall it's definitely we're in a much better place after week 11 this year than we were last year, just because we have beaten the teams we should have beat this year, and we've kind of lost to the teams we should have lost to. I mean, yeah, Temple just dropped their second game this year, but they're a legit team with a defense that returned 11 starters. Personally, preseason, that was the game I was most concerned about. Aside from, you know, the big three in our division, which is Michigan, Michigan State, and Ohio State, I was really concerned about Temple just because, in my opinion, Rule's a legit coach. And they did return all of their defensive starters off of a top 50 in every statistical category defense. And that proved to be – not that I want to say I told you so, but I told you so. And then, you know, last year we lost – to teams we really should have beaten. We lost a one-point game to Maryland. We lost to Illinois. And we lost to a really crappy Northwestern team last year. And, yeah, we lost to Northwestern this year, but Northwestern's not the 2014 Northwestern this year. They're actually not bad. And right now our three losses are Northwestern, Ohio State, and Temple. And in my opinion, those aren't bad losses. So we've beaten the teams we should beat this year, which we couldn't really say last year, and we're trending up. 7-3 is not a horrible place to be 11 weeks into the year, especially when we had to play 10 straight games and we just got our bye in the 11th week of the year. And we almost had a chance to beat a ranked team on the road in our 10th straight game. So I think that we're trending in a positive direction. We have a really, really strong recruiting class coming in 2016. After a really strong recruiting class in 2015. We have flaws, like any really young team does. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of our fan base that are just not content, and I think they won't ever be content. As you guys are aware, being Michigan,
yeah,
there's always going to be fans that, you know, want to win a national title every year, and they won't be happy unless you're in that conversation. At, you know, the last week of November, every year they want to be in the national title race. And I think that that's unrealistic, especially with where we were, you know, just last year, let alone 2-3 years ago, let alone 5 years ago. So I'm pretty bullish about where we're headed as a program. So
you know, the biggest thing that I think was the problem last year is the fact that you just didn't have any offensive linemen. You go into that Temple game, you know, Hackenberg gets sacked 700 times, once on a two-man rush.
I believe that is an exact count, too.
And it seems like, you know, it's been a struggle, but, you know, they've recovered from that. It hasn't been like the kind of season-destroying liability that it looked Like, how does the offensive line look going into a game against a Michigan defensive line that suddenly has sprung some holes in the absence of Ryan Glasgow?
Well, I think that part of the reason why the offensive line has looked better, and part of it is on the offensive line and that they've played, you know, 10 games now together and have started to move better together. But part of it has been that the offense has found their star running back in Saquon Barkley. He didn't really play much against Temple. He didn't really play much until the third week. But this kid is an absolute star in the making. He's leaped over dudes. It's absolutely ridiculous what this true freshman can do. On our podcast, we call him the truth. He's just ridiculous, the talent that he brings, and he brings in an extra dimension, and he can find holes where there aren't any holes. And when you have that kind of dimension, which we didn't have in 2014, we didn't really have any running game to speak of at all, literally the entire season. I think maybe we had two or three games where we got more than 120, 130 yards on the ground. And when you don't have that, the opposing defenses obviously can make it very easy to make you one-dimensional and then make it very easy to get to your quarterback. So with Barkley, it's much more difficult for those opposing defenses to make the offense one-dimensional. In the Michigan game, in the Maryland game, the actual focus of the Maryland defense was to shut down Saquon Barkley. And the result of that was that Hackenberg beat Maryland through the air and was throwing bombs downfield, and it worked. So it proved that we are a multidimensional offense when we can be this year. And I think that's what made the offensive line look much better later on is finding that dynamic with, running back and Saquon Barkley. And seriously, you may not be Penn State fans, but this kid, man, he's electric.
You know, I've seen him. I think he's good enough that Miles Sanders should probably just come to Michigan.
Oh, really? Oh,
I think that's how much Sanders, I. That's how.
If Sanders or any ends running up back flipping, for that you know matter, he's going to be a Pitt Panther. I mean, come on now.
So, Hackenberg has been, I think, very much a wild card. You know, everyone saw the vine of the wide receiver screen that wasn't even the same area code, but we've also seen him hit multiple 40-yard passes downfield. You know, he's flashes that NFL talent periodically, but you know, sometimes it kind of just seems like he gets frustrated with what's going on and he kind of goes in a bad place. Is that a fair characterization of him?
I think that absolutely is fair. I mean, if you look at the Illinois game this year and then the first half of the Northwestern game, that illustrates those two points that you just made. The Illinois game, he looked money. It was like every throw that he made, even those screen passes you just alluded to, were right on target. I think he ended up the day like something ridiculous, like 24 of 29, and he even had a reception for a touchdown, which as a essentially pro-style quarterback is kind of unheard of. But a lot of those incompletions were not even on him. They were on his receivers dropping passes that were in their hands because they didn't even expect that Hack would be able to get them the ball. So that Illinois game, which we won 39-0, it was like he could do no wrong. And you watch that game and you're like, this is why he was projected to be a first-round draft pick, right?
Yeah.
But then first quarter of that Northwestern game, he started out something ridiculous like 1 for 11, where he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. He was making poor decisions. And granted, it wasn't just him. Our entire team, offense, defense, we shut them out in the first quarter, but the offense and the special teams came out looking incredibly flat. It wasn't just on Hack. It was on literally everyone on that offense, but Hack personifies that because as a quarterback, you are the face of the offense. If that's the game that you watch, you're looking at it going, there's no way this kid is going to play in the league, let alone be drafted in the first two rounds.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So is there anything that seems to trigger this kind of thing? Like, you know, 260 or some yards against Army versus, you know, just annihilating a couple of different teams. It just seems like it's so up and down. Is there something that you can see that causes the up or down?
In his defense, the Army game, there was really bad weather. Actually, three of our first four home games were rain, were in rain. So I don't necessarily think the Army game is a good barometer of his capabilities. That's why I feel like the first half of the Northwestern game is possibly a better indicator of where his mind can go, because the weather wasn't a non-factor in that game. I think that one of the things he's been working on, and you can see it in the Illinois game, is his footwork. Is when he has time to get set and actually step up into his throws and step up into the pocket, that's when he can be money. But I don't know. I mean, you saw it to the end of last year where he had been getting sacked, and not even just sacked, but getting hit so much that he was hearing footsteps even when they weren't even there. And that was...
Yeah, we call that Devin Gardner disease.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we know what that looks like.
I didn't know what to call it, because Wes Lunt was definitely hearing those at the end of the Illinois game, to the point where he was just like throwing the ball into the ground and just saying, I give up every time Carl Nassib was coming near him. But I just don't know. I don't know what it is. At some points you can see that he just loses faith in the offense. But then it seems to be a week to week thing. And I don't know. I think overall in 2015, he's consistently gotten better, and you can see it just in the vibe that he's given off with his teammates and with the coaching staff. And I think that even at the beginning of 2015, they weren't calling the downfield passes. They kept calling the short passes, which you mentioned, he's just not as good at the short and intermediate throws as he is on the downfield lobs, which I think you guys might remember from a certain night game in 2013, but he just has been, as the season progresses, the coaching staff has trusted him more to put the ball where his receivers and only his receivers can make those plays downfield, and they've been calling those plays. And actually, one of the much better things, too, in 2015 about Hackenberg is his touchdown-to-interception ratio, because Northwestern actually did intercept the ball this past week, but it was his first interception since, I want to say, week two or three. So he's been much better at taking care of the ball this year than he was last year.
Let's actually talk about Carl Nassib, who you mentioned. Carl Nassib is a walk-on who's currently leading Division I in sacks. I mean, where did this guy come from?
The Brailsworth Trophy, which is given to the nation's best former walk-on, which was actually won by Matt McGloin in 2012.
I mean,
I don't know that.
I mean, Matt McGloin was a quarterback, but he was not the best quarterback in the country. So, I mean,
no, but the Brailsworth doesn't go to the best quarterback in the country. It goes to the
I'm aware of that. I'm just where did this guy come from? Did you guys expect this to happen? Like,
he didn't even start. He hasn't even started a game before the Temple game. He hadn't even started a football game since high school. So Bill O'Brien actually offered him a preferred walk-on spot. And he got, I believe he switched to a scholarship spot his junior year is when he got offered the scholarship. But honestly, many of us preseason didn't predict that he would even be starting by the end of the year, because we thought that Torrance Brown, who's now, I believe, a redshirt freshman, would surpass Carl Nassib. So this took most of us by legitimate shock. We none of us expected Nassib to be the beast that he is. But Nassib is obviously a phenomenal defensive end, and don't get me wrong, but a lot of the reason why Nassib has had such a great season and why he will be drafted probably, I'm going to say, fourth, fifth round, is because our two defensive tackles are such big space eaters. Zettel and Johnson are just ridiculous. Possibly the best, with some of the best defensive tackles in the nation. The tandem, both of them together, are, you know, offensive coordinators have to game plan around them. So they are eating up double teams together, and that frees up the guys on the outside to just wreak havoc on quarterbacks. And Nassib is doing it. He's now the single sack leader in Penn State history for a season, and we still have three games to go.
That is quite impressive. So Jordan Lucas was a key member of the secondary. He's out for the year. How's Penn State coping with that?
I'm not sure yet because we haven't seen it. I mean, it just happened in the second or third quarter of Northwestern. So we'll probably shift around and have Malik Golden fill his safety spot. Now, Jordan Lucas actually played corner all of his career until this year.
Yeah.
So we'll see how they shift around. We also, I mean, this is not our first season-ending loss on the defense because we lost Naeem Wortman White in the first game. And actually, Lucas was wearing Naeem Wortman White's number for a couple games.
Taunted.
Because they are such good friends. So it is really unfortunate, especially because Lucas was a true senior. So his Penn State career is now over, and he was one of the most vocal leaders on the defense. But like I said, Malik Golden probably will be stepping up in his stead. Golden actually has seen significant time in all his years at Penn State, but never been a full-time starter. But he's been in nickel and dime situations significantly. So he's seen significant time. He's just never really been a full-time starter in that safety position. But Marcus Allen has been the other safety the rest of the year, and we joke that he's going to get flagged for killing a guy sometime because he's just very he's very aggressive at that safety position. The issue with Allen that you'll see, though, is if Peppers is actually on offense, as he sometimes is, he might be able to take advantage of this, but Allen sometimes doesn't wrap up very well when he tackles. He kind of arm tackles occasionally because he's just going in for the hit rather than the actual sure tackle. So,
How's your special teams been this year?
Next question.
I see. Given that...
I'm gonna say this. I've watched four Michigan games this year. I've watched your two losses, and I've watched Indiana. I've watched Minnesota. So I'm not the most indicative of Michigan's overall body of work, but I watched that Michigan State game.
Yes.
Until
the very end.
Well, no, I don't even want to talk about the very end because we all know what happened at the very end. But your special teams are the reason why you were winning until the very end.
Yeah,
your special teams are ridiculous. And that is the facet of the game that scares me the most because ours are awful.
Well, that's good to hear. Michigan has actually had a couple of issues the last couple of weeks, if that makes you feel any better. How are you feeling?
Ours is just really bad.
How are you feeling overall about this game? How do you expect it to play out? Yeah. Give me a prediction.
I expect it to be very defensive. I mean, I think that obviously Rudock being a fifth-year senior, that's worked out really great for you guys. It's worked out obviously really great for Iowa as well, obviously. But it's worked out very well for Michigan. But I still think that Penn State has such a strong defense, but Michigan has such a strong defense. And I think that we are undefeated at home this year, and that definitely benefits Penn State. I don't see it continuing just because your defense is so strong and your offense is enough better than our offense that I just don't see it. I see it being very low scoring. I think your special teams is just enough better than ours that the field position will be enough in Michigan's favor that they'll low scoring.
That they'll grind it out?
Yeah. Something in the realm of like 17-14 Michigan, like very, very low scoring. What is the over under right now? Do you guys know?
I'm not sure what the over under is right now, but that would probably come in under it.
I think so. I mean, last I checked, the line was, I think, Michigan by 5.
Yeah.
So I think that we'll will cover, but I don't. I think that you guys will pull it out and then go into the game ready to. I also think that Ohio State will beat Michigan State, so I think that you'll be ready to spoil Ohio State's season.
Awesome, thank you, Carrie. We have to take a break and get out of here. But thank you for coming on.
No problem. We will
talk to you maybe next year. This is MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. So, Ace, it's time for the guys of the week who we think will do well at accruing points and DraftKings and stuff of the week.
Still catchy.
It's good. I like it.
Yeah.
It's we're watching BoJack Horseman. That might be why. But anyway, last week, who did I pick, Ace?
I believe it was Jake Rudock.
It was Jake Rudock.
And well, I think I gave you some guff for that because I was concerned about your track record.
Well, hey, come on. I got the Western Kentucky quarterback when they played Indiana. I'm sensing a trend.
It's just that trend usually breaks when it comes to Michigan quarterbacks. But, you know, last week worked out just fine. So I think you can possibly continue rolling with that if you are so inclined.
You spoiled it. You spoiler alert, everybody. Yes, I'm going with Jake Rudock again because let it ride, baby.
Let it ride.
And Penn State, their defense sucks, right?
Let's pretend it does.
All right, we're doing that. Who you got?
I'm taking Ohio State receiver Michael Thomas because he is playing Michigan State secondary, which
is the Indiana of secondaries.
It is.
Also, Indiana is the Indiana of secondaries, but...
But they're playing Maryland this week, so I couldn't pick anybody on Maryland. So, which is really too bad because that would have been the easy choice. But Michael Thomas, Ohio State's pretty clear-cut number one target. He's in a game where they should be throwing the ball a decent amount.
They're going up against a very bad, bad team. So, yes.
Yeah, going with him.
That's a pretty good, decent pick. All right, this has been the DraftKings thing that we think that will do well of the week with the players of the week. Go to DraftKings.com, type in AMGO blog, and you will get, I think it's heaven, is that what it? No, or is it just extra money? I think it's just extra money.
You'll have to click to find out.
That's a teaser.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshore Lending. By now, you've probably read about my company on AMGO blog, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7.5.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have 3 really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
HomeSure Lending.
Good boys. HomeSure Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you. HomeSureLending.com. HomeSure Lending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
HomeSure Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
Sports Talk, 1050 WTKA.
Welcome back to MGO Radio, presented by Underground Printing and Moe's. That song is already kind of slow, which makes it bad ukulele cover. The good ukulele covers are just completely ridiculous because it's like a happy, like hurt on ukulele would be fantastic. We've really spent too much time this week talking about ukulele covers. We did find out that there is a UK organization called the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain that is hugely popular, like unbelievably sellout crowd popular, and they covered all kinds of things. They covered Smelled Like Teen Spirit. They covered rap songs too, which is rap songs, rapists. So Penn State is an interesting game upcoming. Michigan has cracked a little bit on the defensive line, but will that be enough for Penn State, which does not have the kind of offensive line that Indiana has, to get Michigan? I don't know. It's a very weird thing to be saying, but it is also a true thing to be saying. So, you know, I think the key matchup really comes down to whether or not Hurst and Godin and Henry and Wormley can hold up enough against the run to prevent that kind of like runaway train effect we found late in the Indiana game, where everybody was just so tired that they lost the plot. So that kind of like, I mean, if Saquon Barkley rips off a 20-yard run and then goes in the line twice and it's 2nd and 6, I mean, that's fine. But if they keep giving up the 5, 6, 7, 8 yard runs, then I think you can maybe find a way for Penn State's offense to look a lot better than you would expect Penn State's offense to look against a defense that until last week had been just completely lights out. But I also think that, you know, Indiana is secretly one of the best offenses in the country. And because they had injury issues with Sudfeld, they had injury issues even with their backup quarterback. They had to go through the entire Penn State game with backups, and their third stringer played a lot of that game. That this is a team that, you know, even Ohio State's offense has not been as consistently good as Indiana's has when they've had their guys. So obviously a step back for Michigan, but maybe not one that is as bad as it appears right now in the heat of the moment. So, you know, keep the faith and Harbaugh on, everybody. On the other side of the ball, it's going to be whether Jake Rudock can maintain his performance under a lot of duress, I think, because that defensive line by Michigan, of Penn State's, is really one of the best in the country. And there's no question about that. And if Rudock can stand in the pocket, find guys, because I think they're going to find open guys, because Penn State's secondary is not great. They're good. They're not great. Then you can win that game, and then you can go into the Ohio State game thinking, like, maybe Jake Rudock, of all people, can figure it out for us. But we will see on Saturday. So that's it for our show. Now, up next is the Inside Michigan Coaches Show with Jim Harbaugh. We would like to thank our sponsors, Underground Printing, Anthony Ciotti. He's not a sponsor. Home Share Lending, DraftKings, the Residence Inn, Ann Arbor Downtown, Ann Arbor Elder Law, Tailgater Concierge, Kerry Green from Black Shoe Diaries, and of course, Home Share Lending. We will see you next week, guys. Better than